So first of all, we're going to start out with a patient, a younger patient, a 56-year-old patient, a man, a carer that you took care of. We're mainly going to focus, because here we're going to kind of get into the basics of prostate cancer management. And we picked this case because he actually has received a lot of the therapies that patients typically receive. He's had surgery, radical prostatectomy, presented. We'll talk about what this means with a Gleason score of 5+4. He had salvage radiation therapy, and he's also had a couple forms of endocrine therapy, androgen deprivation, as well as abiraterone, prednisone. Vicky, can you just kind of overview, Kara, can you overview a little bit about this man and sort of how he experienced these various prostate cancer treatments and how you prepared him for them?
Sure. That's a great question. So he's really lovely guy he's really fit. He's really active and was diagnosed with prostate cancer during a regular annual follow-up and was promptly referred to urology, where he underwent a prostatectomy that revealed a high grade Gleason score. And throughout the course of his care, post-prostatectomy and reviewing his pathology, it really was apparent he had a very high-grade cancer and was very young. And so based on those features, we recommended more aggressive therapy with radiation and hormone therapy. And so through each of those phases, we really took the opportunity to talk about what the expectations would be from each therapy, from surgery, from radiation, from primary hormone therapy, and then additional hormone therapy with side effects and what to expect physically and how to prepare for work and home life balance. And so I think education along each of those steps was important, as the side effects from surgery, recovering surgically, are different than the fatigue you might feel going through radiation and starting hormone therapy. So talked a lot about importance of maintaining health with bone health and maintaining muscle mass, and how to manage the side effects of vasomotor flushing and changes in libido with hormone therapy.
So we're going to use this case. We're going to come back to this case and hear a little bit more about some of the issues that came up as he was being managed. But just sort of as a way to sort of get started, Rob, can you talk a little bit about how men with prostate cancer usually present and where this grading system, we said that this man has a Gleason 9 prostate cancer, kind of what that means?
Sure. Things have evolved. Most men still are found by PSA-based screening and come to a diagnosis that way. Obviously, some patients will present with more advanced disease. Dr. Gleason, the late Dr. Gleason, who died in his 90s, was a surgical pathologist who basically derived a system that allows pathologists to look at microscopic features of biopsy and categorize them. And in the modern timeline, pathologist looks at a bunch of slides. The most common pattern is ascribed a 3, 4, or 5, and the second or least common 3, 4, or 5, and you add the numbers together. So higher numbers, 8, 9, and 10, are poor biology. Lower numbers, better biology. And generally, it conforms to its behavior.
So Matthew, and another issue that's come up, and oncologists don't get involved as much of this as urologists, is whether even the patient needs to be treated. And in recent years, for patients who have lower grade tumors with a better prognosis, for example, so-called Gleason 6, you see some men being observed. Can you kind of talk about sort of how that decision is made, Matthew, about whether to treat or not, and then how to choose in terms of local therapy between surgery and radiation therapy?
Sure. So certainly there's a long tradition of over-diagnosis and over-treatment. That's one of the reasons that PSA screening is controversial. It does a particularly good job at diagnosing early prostate cancers, many of which don't need treatment. And we and others have been, used active surveillance for a long time. But the good news is, in one of the more important changes in the field, is we now have evidence supporting that based on a randomized controlled trial that took men with mostly low-risk prostate cancer and assigned them to either observation, surgery, or radiation therapy. And at least with 10 years of follow-up, there's no difference in overall survival. So for men who have shorter life expectancies of 10 years or less, we can, I think, comfortably recommend surveillance. And it's also can be appropriate for younger men, although I don't consider that observation then, but it really is active surveillance with greater intensity of screening at baseline to exclude a clinically significant cancer and closer follow-up to intervene with treatment as appropriate.
So Vicki, you in your talk that we're going to be posting, you had a number of really interesting slides where you sort of put together some ideas related to prostate cancer management from the point of view of the nurse. And one of them was this slide right here, which is kind of an overview of prostate cancer. Maybe you can comment a little bit on that, Vicki.
So prostate cancer is still a major health issue in the United States. So more and there is a more increased risk for us as nurses to actually be seeing these patients in our practice. And it is so important for us to keep abreast of the patient issues, the current treatments that they've had, what the associated side effects could be for certain treatments, nursing interventions that can help mitigate some of the side effects that could occur, and to ensure the best quality of life for your patient. The treatment that is generally picked depends on the diagnosis. We're looking at stage and grade of the tumor. As Rob discussed, we're looking at comorbidities of the patient, prior therapies. The overall performance status is a biggie in terms of seeing how your patients are going to do with these various treatments. And I guess the most important thing these days is, what is your patient's desires in terms of goals? What is it that they want? Do they want more years to their life, or do they want improved quality of life? These are real important things to consider when you're treating your patients.
So, Kara, another issue, and it's kind of a theme of our work over the years in nursing education, is why was it different to take care of this patient than another person with the same oncology situation, but a different person? Can you talk a little bit, Kara, as you manage this man, some of the issues that came up with him? You were commenting to me that he had a, you know, one of the issues was anxiety and depression.
Sure. Yeah. This gentleman had, he did not have a partner when he was diagnosed. And I think that played a role because partners provide great supports when someone is diagnosed with cancer. They are often a second set of ears to listen to the information about diagnosis, to help tease out, like Vicki said, what are your priorities for life and what is your goal? And so it's often helpful to have a partner or family member who can help you do that. And so he has tackled a lot of that alone, which really stood out to Matthew and me as an important piece to remember. And then I think his desire to have a partner was really challenged when he had this diagnosis. As we think about the side effects of a prostatectomy, of radiation, of hormone therapy, those are things that are hard to talk to about new partners and can really make patients feel isolated. And so for this gentleman, the further he went into his treatment, the more isolated he felt. And as he tried to approach what it would look like to have a partner, it created a lot of anxiety. And then as the side effects of treatment started to settle in, his anxiety really increased. And he had a hard time verbalizing that until it reached sort of a really critical point. So that was really unique, his young age and side effects for him.
So yeah, I should have mentioned that this is actually a patient of Matthew's as well. You both work with this man. Matthew, any comments or observation about him as a person and some of the issues Kara was just commenting on?
Yeah, absolutely. So a couple things, you know, and this comes back to the point that Rob made that, you know, most of these prostate cancers are diagnosed by screening. And I think it's really challenging for patients to go in for a well visit and to within a matter of weeks being told that they have not only cancer, but a serious, potentially life-threatening cancer. And then he had like, you know, a series of further bad news along the way, you know, upgrading and upstaging at the time of surgery, elevated PSA after surgery, need for additional systemic treatment. So really, really challenging. And in some ways, strangely, it's harder for such patients than those who present with symptoms of their cancer, and then now they understand why they're sick. with prostate cancer, we're often, you know, patients are learning that they have a serious diagnosis for which they have no symptoms. And we're intervening not to, in some cases, not to improve symptoms, but to improve longer-term outcomes. And that can be a difficult calculation for the patient. This gentleman really, I think, to put it succinctly, viewed himself as damaged as a consequence of his treatment, both, you know, the sexual side effects of his treatment, his challenges of finding another partner for which he'd want to be intimate, and then also the recognition that this cancer may well alter his life expectancy. So there's really a lot to take on for this young man.
So Vicky, when you really think about it, actually prostate cancer management in many ways is really completely unique in oncology, particularly in terms of some of the sexual side effects of the therapies that we use, as Matthew was just talking about. We're going to talk a little bit about sort of the strategy of managing the various states systemically. We could talk all day long about local therapy, but you know, in oncology, we're going to focus more on systemic therapy. But any comments in general, Vicky, about you know assessing and managing a sexual dysfunction and men with prostate cancer, and maybe words of advice for nurses out in the field, you know, based on your experience about what's an effective way to try to address this important topic?
So in my own experience, I feel as though if I approach the subject and I bring it up with the patient and his partner, they are very open to it and they discuss it very openly. If I wait for them to actually ask me about it, that may never happen. I know a lot of the physicians are very reluctant to actually approach the sexuality. And it's mainly the younger doctors who, again, they don't have a lot of experience with this. And I think they're uncomfortable with it. So, but I think that our patients, they want you to ask them about their sexuality. They want you to tell them that there's going to be an issue. And it's really important that both the partner and the patient are there, because if you give hormonal therapy and the patient loses his libido and has erectile dysfunction and the partner doesn't know that this is a side effect from therapy, they're going to think something's wrong with them. And I've had that, I've had a partner come to me and ask me, they said, you know, I think something's wrong with me. So you know, when you get this, when you hear this over and over, you know, it is an issue and we as nurses are the ones that need to address it.
Kara, any comments about how this played out in this man, a much more challenging situation because no partner? How were your conversations with him about his sexual functions?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I really spent some time trying to understand what his life is like. So I think taking a history is so important. And I think we've all sort of talked about that at the beginning of this, to sort of understanding where patients are coming from when they're diagnosed. And so just asking him about what his life is like at home, what were the hobbies that he enjoyed doing, and who did he do it with? And through that conversation, he revealed that he wanted a partner and he was dating somebody new and he wasn't sure how to communicate in lay terms what his diagnosis meant. He really was able to comprehend medically the information we had given him about his diagnosis, but he didn't know how to communicate that to a non-medical new partner. So how much should I tell that partner? What should I say? And how do I not make them afraid that I'm going to die and this is going to be bad? So we sort of broke it down really step by step for what are the side effects of your treatment? How long do we think these side effects will last? And also talked about different ways to approach intimacy with a new partner when that time felt right.
So we got getting some great questions in the chat room that we're going to try to address, but I want to sort of lay out where we're heading with this sort of prelude, because we're really going to focus on three let's say clinical scenarios that men with prostate cancer may be involved with in terms of treatment. And I'm going to show this slide here that Matt actually had in his deck, but I'm actually going to ask Rob to comment on it. You know, the three things, and maybe you can go through sort of the natural history, Rob, because what we're going to talk about today is, first of all, managing the man who's had some type of local therapy, but now has a rising PSA, so the so-called M0 disease, no evidence of metastasis other than the PSA. We're also going to talk about so-called endocrine-sensitive metastatic disease, patients who have metastatic disease but have never had hormonal therapy. That could be somebody who presents with metastatic disease. We have a case like that. Or somebody who had local therapy in the past and now has metastatic disease. And then the third clinical scenario we're going to talk about are men with metastatic disease who already have had hormonal therapy, and we'll talk about how that affects them, and have disease progression on top of that, so-called castrate-resistant disease. Rob, can you sort of elaborate on that model in terms of how men present in these various scenarios, and then we're going to go through sort of how they're managed?
Sure. Dr. Smith has adapted work that Howard Scher, our colleague at Memorial Sloan Kettering, published 20 years ago. And it's gotten really complicated. Dr. Smith has sort of decoupled some of the complex things. Prostate cancer changes over time. 1986, 87, PSA is described. So before that, patients underwent local treatment, surgery, radiotherapy. And we said, okay, see ya. And they presented or they didn't present with metastatic disease. So PSA has really revolutionized many things. So we call it biochemical failure or PSA failure. And then when you introduce hormonal therapy into this milieu, the construct of castrate resistant or hormone sensitive disease, and then progression to metastatic disease. So the reason why these what so-called clinical states are so important is we're able to sort of look at these disease states, do prospective trials, address questions about changing the natural history of the disease. And this gives us a framework to do that.
So, Vicki, you know, usually the first systemic therapy for prostate cancer is so-called androgen deprivation to remove the testosterone. Can you talk about how that's done, what the therapies are, and sort of how patients experience that in terms of tolerability and side effects?
So hormonal therapy is the gold standard of treatment for patients who present with metastatic disease. It is quite scary for patients who are young. And the reason is because the biggest side effect is erectile dysfunction, impotency. Yes, those are the main words that your patient will hear. You're going to say, well, you know, you could develop increased weight, muscle loss, you could have some decrease in your memory. But the main side effect that your patient is going to, that's going to stick in his head, is going to be the erectile dysfunction and the decrease in libido. And that is what patients need to actually get over. You have to kind of support them through it and help them through it, let them know what's going on with their disease status and what would happen if they didn't undergo hormonal therapy. But hormonal therapy is given by injection. It's it comes in all kinds of different depot injections. You could get it monthly injection, every 3-month injection, every 4-month injection. But it just depends on who is treating you and what that doctor is comfortable in giving you. All are equal in terms of efficacy when you're talking about these hormonal therapies.
So Matthew, can we drill down a little bit more, and we'll get into this issue of benefits in a second, but could you just drill out down a little bit more, Matthew, in terms of androgen deprivation that Vicki was just describing, the different preparations that are used, and also, what are some of the other issues that these men experience in addition to things like hot flashes and sexual dysfunction? And specifically, I'm referring to a lot of the metabolic consequences that occur.
Yeah, so first, an interesting aside, you know, with COVID-19, we've pretty uniformly gone to the longest acting depot formulations of every 6 months just to allow patients to, you know, come to clinic less frequently and do virtual visits in between as needed. So that's sort of a contemporary comment on the current state of affairs. And we expect that for patients who require long-term treatment, that'll continue indefinitely, meaning we'll stick with the longer acting formulations. But Vicki did a beautiful job of describing the key side effects of ADT. There are certainly others. So in addition to the sexual side effects, vasomotor flushing or hot flashes, which while the sexual side effects are bothersome, when treatment's really a deal breaker, a lot of times it's hot flashes that will drive men with the worst hot flashes to want to discontinue treatment. It's also accompanied by fatigue, body composition changes that Vicky mentioned, loss of muscle mass, increase in fat mass, change in body image, which can be very problematic for some men, increased risk of falls and fractures, and a constellation of metabolic complications that at least we believe to be causally related to greater risk for diabetes or worsening diabetes control in individuals who already have a diabetes diagnosis.
Kara, from a sort of lifestyle point of view, what recommendations do you give to men who are in androgen deprivation in terms of exercise, nutrition, stress reduction?
Sure. So I really try and emphasize, as Matthew and Vicky have highlighted, patients experience body composition changes, and that can be really discouraging. So really from the outset of starting hormone therapy, we talk a lot about healthy lifestyle modification as far as diet and weight-bearing exercise. So I think doing a really full assessment of how active are you now? What is your activity like in a day? What is your diet like in a day? And trying to tease out where their baseline is and adding in recommendations that are manageable. So a lot of times there's a lot of feedback from the internet. Patients are often Googling everything and they come in with long lists of all these things they want to try. And I really try and break it down in a small step process. So things, instead of saying, I'm going to walk 10 miles a day so I don't gain any weight, I say, well, how much do you walk now? And let's try and add in a little bit at a time. And if you have ice cream every night, let's try and decrease how much you're doing that. And so I think understanding their baseline helps you slowly modify what they're doing so that they don't sort of go out too big and then get really discouraged when it doesn't feel successful.
I love, being on rounds and hearing all the little tricks that people developed over the years. I've always loved hearing that. We're going to move on in a second and talk about, more specifically, these three clinical scenarios that men often face. But Vicky, you had a slide in your presentation I really like, kind of referring to the challenge of making decisions when there are multiple options in terms of trying to balance the risks and benefits. Just maybe a comment as we begin to sort of dig into these complicated decisions. Any thoughts about sort of the best way to make a shared decision with a patient?
Well, what's interesting is that we as oncologists, we want new drugs. We want to see improved survival. We want to see delayed progression. And we want to see the patients actually psychologically deal with the disease. But unfortunately, along with all of these positive things comes the risk associated with getting the certain treatments. So basically, you have to sit down, talk to the patient, and explain to them exactly what options are available for them, what the potential side effects are, what the overall outcome can be. And you also have to let them know that if they, at any time during their treatment, they are having significant side effects, they can stop the treatment and we will sit down and we'll rediscuss where their disease is and what the next step should be.